You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What
am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
Are you not entertained?
I don't know who you are.
Why so serious?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
If they call me Mr.
Oh, boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
No one!
Everyone!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. I have had one for the books, to be sure. On the lighter side of things, I had hot pot for the first time after wanting to go for years and years. If you don't know, it's basically Korean barbecue, but soup in a different country, because there's multiple countries that have hot pot. But it's like make your own soup at the table. It's very fun. I also ran a big event for my department, which was like 2 months of planning and it went super well. And I feel like I'm going to get like major kudos for the next week. I also got a bullhorn out of it. And I found out, I don't think I've ever used like a megaphone or anything like that before. Really like having a megaphone. That was a interesting, not a surprising realization about myself, because I do love when people listen, have to listen to me, honestly. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this, let's be honest. But yeah, having a literal megaphone it felt natural. Let's put it that way. Then that same night, I actually went to a Q&A for the Lopez versus Lopez show, which is a sitcom that the company I work for does. So that was kind of like my celebration. I got to take a friend, which is always fun. And he's not in the industry. So always fun to take outside industry people to industry things, because they tend to be very, very fun. And yeah, I guess I had kind of a low-key Hollywood week this week, that which is cool. For movie theater movie reviews, I did see Monkey Man this week, which I did enjoy, but I don't give movie reviews for the studio I work for just in case. But yeah, it's good. Other than that, I was working nonstop, so I did not get to see anybody else's movies. For the Criterion pick of the week, I have chosen Spine Number 1001, which is called The Day Trippers. The Criterion Collection introduced like this live channel they have. I think they did that this week, if not this week, last week, where they're just playing 24/7, just like a curated like channel of movies. So if you're indecisive, you can just drop in. It's basically TV. They call it like a live channel. It's a TV channel. It works exactly like a TV channel. You drop in, you get what you get. I figured I'd give it a shot because I am often indecisive. And this is the movie that it picked for me. I knew nothing about this film, but it's got a great cast early in their careers. This came out in like 1996. And it had Hope Davis, Liev Schreiber, Parker Posey, and Stanley Tucci in it. It was a solid indie film that you don't really see get made too much these days, and is about a family who heads into New York City to confront one of the daughter's husbands after she finds a mysterious love letter she believes was written for him. It's the feature film debut for Greg Mottola, who would go on to direct like Superbad and Adventureland. And I'm honestly surprised that this didn't actually net him more film work, because it is a very, very solid debut. And now on to this week's topic. This week, a look at the horrific production of the Twilight Zone movie that led to one of the assistant directors being credited as Alan Smithy. Just a heads up, this episode is going to deal with some pretty gnarly deaths of young people, but the whole situation is an important look at set safety and protecting underage kids on sets. I don't get terribly graphic, just the absolute, like, this is what happened. That's not what we're here for, but it is something that happened. It's, you know, timely, but we'll get to that later. So just a warning. I felt like I should give a warning heads up just to be transparent, but there it is. This is what we're dealing with this week. And with that, let's take our places. It's showtime.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
The year was 1982, 14 years after the birth of Alan Smithy. Shooting just outside of Los Angeles was a segment of the Twilight Zone movie, an anthology film based on the TV show of the same name. What happened on that set would change movie making forever. The Twilight Zone had first beamed into living rooms in 1959. Hosted by Rod Sterling, the sci-fi show is what's known as an anthology series, meaning that the stories and casts of each episode are all independent to their respective episodes, unless it's like a two-parter or like, I can't remember off the top of my head if they ever did sequels, but if they did sequels, obviously the same people would be back, but there you go. Each Twilight Zone episode was fantastical in some aspect and ended with an unexpected twist. The original series ran from 1959 to 1964 and also spun off into radio shows, literature, a board game, comic books, and smattering of other things. So given this franchise's rampant popularity, it wasn't surprising that a film might happen too. When he heard of the possibility of a Twilight Zone movie being made, Steven Spielberg threw his name in the running. He was ultimately tapped to direct one of the segments of this film while also being a producer for the entire project. John Landis of An American Werewolf in London and Animal House fame would be the other producer on the whole project and would also direct the prologue of the film as well as his own segment, which would be shown first once the film was completed. The other two directors of this film, but that aren't really a part of this story, were Joe Dante, who'd famously go on to direct Gremlins in 1984, and George Miller, who was known for the Mad Max franchise. The Twilight Zone film was set up to be a series of retellings of four of the most famous episodes from the original series. They were Time Out, which is only a partial reworking, so not a full remake, of the episode Back There, which involved a man who exits a club after a conversation about the possibility of time traveling to alter the past, only to find that he has inexplicably been transported to the past. The second was a remake of the episode Kick the Can, which was about a group of older people who are transformed one night into their younger selves. The third segment is a remake of the episode It's a Good Life, which is about a man who meets an odd family after running over a stranger's bike and offering them a ride home. The final segment was a remake of Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, one of the most famous episodes of the original series, which takes place on a plane, if the episode name wasn't obvious enough. During the flight, a passenger that's terrified of flying begins seeing a gremlin on the plane's wing, and he obviously starts freaking out because the gremlin is gremlining. Only problem is, he's the only person who can see it happening. But it's what happened during the shooting of this first segment that's our focus for today. In this segment, we meet Bill Connor, played by Vic Morrow. He, the character that is an outspoken bigot who is bitter after being passed over a promotion at work in favor for his Jewish coworker. Drinking in a bar after work with two friends, Bill says some crappy things and throws in some slurs about Jewish people, and for good measure adds stuff about Black people and East Asians, essentially blaming them for America's problems, as one does in public. After ranting some more and declaring himself better than the groups he despises, Bill angrily storms out of the bar and is shocked to find himself in Nazi-occupied France during World War II. A pair of SS officers patrolling the streets spot him and interrogate him because they believe him to be Jewish. Bill cannot answer their questions, though, since he does not speak German. A chase around the city ensues, in which Bill is shot in his left arm by one of the German officers. Bill attempts to hide in an apartment, but the owner of that apartment quickly narcs him out to the officers. Bill climbs out on a ledge of the building, where he finds himself trapped while several German officers take shots at him as he's stranded along this, like, narrow ledge. Bill falls from the ledge and lands on soft ground, now finding himself in rural Alabama during the 1950s, where a group of KKK people see him as a Black man whom they are trying to lynch. Bill tries to tell them that he is white, but obviously they don't believe him. After kicking one KKK member against the burning cross and setting him on fire, Bill manages to break free and tries to escape. He dives into a nearby pond and resurfaces in a jungle in Vietnam during the Vietnam War and is being fired at by American soldiers who see him as a member of the Viet Cong. One of the soldiers throws a grenade at Bill. Instead of killing him, the grenade launches him back into France. There he is captured by the same SS officers and put into a railroad freight car along with other Jewish prisoners that are bound for a concentration camp. Bill sees the bar with his friends standing outside looking for him. He screams for help, but they cannot see or hear him as the train pulls away. During the shooting of a sequence in the Vietnam War section, which was originally set to be much longer, Vic Morrow's character runs away from the American soldiers and is soon pursued by a helicopter while carrying two young Vietnamese children. The situation we're about to discuss happened on the last day of filming. From the jump, the producers for the segment, which were not, well, Landis was the director, but Spielberg was not directly producing this segment. He was a producer for the whole film. And they had producers that were specific to each segment as well. Anyway, these people were making off-the-books decisions. Child actors have very strict guidelines as to when and for how long they can work on set. They are not allowed to be on any night shoots at all. They also aren't allowed to be near any pyrotechnics. You can attempt to get a special permit to allow the children to be around this stuff or to work late, but the filmmakers did not even try to do so, either because they did not think they would get permission for such a late shoot or because they knew they would not get approval to have young children in a scene with a large number of explosives and also a real helicopter flying overhead. To get around these restrictions, John Landis and team illegally hired two child actors whose parents were friends of people who worked on the production. The children hired were 7-year-old Micah Din Lee and 6-year-old Renee Shin Yi Chen. Neither were actors, but they would later be described as outgoing and adventurous. Their parents thought this would be a good experience for them. Since they weren't showbiz parents, they were unaware of the restrictions that children had when it came to stuff like this. To keep the children's participation off the books, the parents were paid in cash, and production was very cognizant about ensuring that the fire and safety officer on set was not aware that the children were on the set or around the boomy boomy stuff. How they were going to get away with this when the film was eventually made, I assume they just didn't care, because, I mean, it's a visual medium. Eventually, people are going to see what got made. So, like, what the hell? Lies were also allegedly told to the children's parents, who were informed that the most intense stimuli the children would have to deal with was some loud noises. An associate producer also allegedly told the children's parents not to tell any of the firefighters on set that the children were part of the scene. The fire safety officer was concerned the blast would cause a crash, but he did not tell Landis of his concerns. Another rule for child actors is that at least one parent or guardian needs to be on set at all times with their kid. Of course, this was also not followed. They were kept further away from the set as to not freak out when they saw what they were doing with the kids. We're kind of getting into the intense part now, so if you want to skip ahead a little bit, now's the time, maybe about 2 minutes. I don't get graphic, like I said, but I just wanted to mention it. Future Caitlin here. It's about 3 minutes and some change from right now. In the early hours of July 23rd, 1982, a final sequence was scheduled involving Vic Morrow's character and the two children. Morrow carries the two children in his arms as they are chased by a helicopter that's firing artillery rounds at them. The set for this was built at Indian Dunes, which was a film ranch that was near Six Flags Magic Mountain. If you're familiar with the Southern California layout, it's like 45 minutes north of LA, I think. I don't go there terribly often, but it's people commute from that area. It's not terribly far away. This set was of a Vietnamese village that was on a shallow stream. Rounding out the sequence was an authentic Bell UH-1 Iroquois helicopter, which would be piloted by Vietnam veteran Dorsey Wingo. While he was qualified to pilot this craft, he was not used to how the chain of command on a film set worked. Wingo was scheduled to do 3 flights of the helicopter that night, which would allow for all the angles the filmmakers wanted. They were shooting with multiple cameras at once as well to minimize the number of flights. The first flight went well enough, though Wingo did complain that the pyrotechnics were being triggered too close to the helicopter, causing him to lose the ability to see out the windows. While I'm no helicopter pilot, I feel like that's a crucial element of being able to fly the sky car, is being able to see out of the windows. These concerns fell on deaf ears, whose ears exactly would be a point of contention later on. Whatever the case, Wingo was told by a member of production to not worry about it. The second flight would be catastrophic. It was about 2:30 a.m. at this point, and the children and Morrow sequence was next. For this next sequence, Wingo flew the helicopter about 25 feet off of the ground. In the chopper with him were 6 crew members. Director John Landis was safely on the ground away from danger and calling his direction into a walkie-talkie. As Morrow runs into the river, a child under each arm as the squibs are going off around them, Wingo was hovering near a large mortar pyrotechnic and turned the aircraft 180 degrees to the left for the next camera shot. A pyrotechnic was triggered while the helicopter's tail rotor was still above it, and the metal lid on top of the mortar struck the tail, causing the rotor on the tail to fail and detach from the back of the helicopter. Because of this, the helicopter began to spin out of control. Based on the footage that was shown at the trial, which you can find online, if that's your thing, it's very graphic, I will warn you ahead of time. At this exact time, Moro dropped Chen into the water. He was reaching out to grab her when the helicopter fell on top of him and the two kids. Moro and Lee were decapitated by the helicopter's main rotor blades, while Chen was crushed to death by the helicopter's right landing skid. All three died basically instantly. Emergency first responders were summoned, but of course it was in vain. Wingo and a few of the crew members were taken in to the hospital and treated for minor injuries, but nothing life-threatening. The parents of both children that were present were also taken to the hospital as they were screaming and crying and were diagnosed with shock. Legend has it that before shooting this scene, Moro had allegedly said to a production assistant, quote, "I must be out of my mind to be doing this. I should have asked for a stunt double. But what can they do but kill me, right?" While he was filming another movie about 10 years prior, he'd apparently insisted on having a $1 million life insurance policy before he would shoot any scenes involving the helicopter he rode in that picture. He was very insistent, and when asked why, Moro allegedly replied, "I have always had a premonition that I was going to die in a helicopter crash." At Vic Morrow's funeral, mourners that attended were shocked to see that John Landis, whom many people and the public were blaming for what happened, and rightfully so in my opinion, showed up to quote-unquote pay his respects. He was not invited and also gave a eulogy at the funeral. During this, he mourned the loss of Moro, but also said in the speech in front of his family and loved ones and everybody who cared about this man that how he had died was a freak accident, one that couldn't have been prevented. He also showed up, again uninvited, to the children's funerals as well. Steven Spielberg was so disgusted by Landis's handling of this situation and then the trial that followed that he ended his relationship with Landis, his friendship with Landis, and publicly called for the end of the new Hollywood era in which directors have been given almost complete control over their films. Spielberg would later say in the press, quote, "No movie is worth dying for. I think people are standing up much more now and even before to producers and directors who ask too much. If something isn't safe, it's the right and responsibility of every actor or crew member to yell, cut." It would also turn out that the scene that these people died making wasn't even in the official shooting script, for obvious reasons, but was added to soften the blow of what a terrible man Bill was. Co-director on the Twilight Zone film, George Miller, was so disgusted by this entire scenario, he abandoned post-production of his segment without announcement, leaving Joe Dante to finish it. When the Twilight Zone movie released in June 1983, it was met with mixed reviews. The scenes that had been shot with the children were not used in the final cut of Landis's segment, and enough of the footage had been shot for the sequence for it to be more or less unaffected. Like I said, they were on the last night of shooting. The Vietnam scenes only included a scene of Bill in a river trying to get help from American GIs before one of them throws the grenade at him and catapults him back into Nazi France. The film was financially successful despite middling reviews because the public interest in this was incredibly high. It's very morbid. People like morbid. It's just, unfortunately, how we are. This renewed interest actually led to a reboot of the Twilight Zone series, which would be airing during the subsequent trials that stemmed from this accident. In the wake of this tragedy, the National Transportation Safety Board launched an investigation into what happened on the Twilight Zone set that fateful July night. The conclusion was what I'd mentioned earlier, that the pyrotechnics had damaged the helicopter and caused it to crash. The reason the crash happened was evident. Who was to blame was another matter entirely. The accident would lead to several civil cases and a criminal one against the filmmakers, which lasted nearly a decade, all of these legal proceedings. Five individuals on the set, including Landis and Wingo, were indicted on the day the film released. 3 days later, Warner Brothers and three of the five individuals, Landis, the production manager, and an associate producer, were fined a total of $82,000 in civil fines as a direct result of the crash. In December of 1983, the families of the deceased reached an initial settlement deal with Landis and Spielberg. But there was still a criminal trial to be had as well. Landis, associate producer George Fulzy, Wingo, production manager Dan Allingham, and explosive specialist Paul Stewart were the individuals charged in this case. Each was facing three counts of gross negligence and three charges of death under unlawful conditions, which equates to manslaughter. An initial trial was set, but was dismissed due to lack of evidence. On appeal, it went to full trial. The jurors were heavily monitored by the press and public and were even required to go to the crash site and watch a reenactment of what happened. They also apparently believed that Landis was going to make a movie about the trial. This was not true. And believed they would all get to play themselves because he was going to ask them to do that. Knowing that, it kind of makes sense given what the outcome of this case ended up being. Lee's father would testify that he heard Landis instructing the helicopter to fly lower. All four parents testified that they were never told that there would be helicopters or explosives on set and that they had been reassured that there would be no danger, only noise. Lee's father, who had survived the Vietnam War and emigrated with his wife to the United States, was horrified when the explosions began on the Vietnamese village set as it reminded him strongly of his own past trauma. The defense would claim that all of the parents were lying and that the parents knew exactly what was going to happen the whole time. There are a litany of conflicting reports as to what the parents were told. The defense would repeatedly try to get a mistrial, but were denied. During his testimony, Wingo claimed that he had asked Morrow to watch out for the helicopter and further stated that Morrow, quote, had over 5 seconds between the time that the sound of the helicopter changed and that impact, but later clarified that he was not attempting to place blame. Wingo's comments were universally discredited, including by the prosecutor, who during cross-examination pushed back on Wingo's assessment and asked how Morrow could have possibly done this while carrying two children in his arms. Also, at the trial, the defense claimed that the explosions were detonated at the wrong time. Randall Robinson, an assistant cameraman on board the helicopter, testified that production manager Dan Allingham had told Wingo, quote, "That's too much, let's get out of here," when the explosions were detonated, but Landis shouted over the radio to get lower. Robinson said that Wingo tried to get away from the set, but they lost control before he was able to do that. Stephen Lidecker, who was another cameraman that was on the helicopter, testified that Landis had earlier, quote-unquote, shrugged off warnings about the stunt with the comment, quote, "We may lose the helicopter." Lidecker would also state that Landis might have been joking when he made that remark, but added, quote, "I learned not to take anything the man said as a joke. It was his attitude. He did not have time for suggestions from anybody." Landis claimed this conversation never occurred. Other things Landis was accused of was joking about being thrown in jail for hiring the children and putting them near pyrotechnics, ignoring other safety warnings on set on different scenes, including using live ammunition on set, which is a monumental no-no. While they would all admit to the illegal hiring of the children, other than that, they all claimed they did nothing wrong. On May 29th, 1987, Landis, Fulzy, Wingo, Allingham, and Stewart were all acquitted on charges of manslaughter in a bitter 9-month trial. The whole thing was a media circus, which culminated each day with the lawyers standing in a hallway of the courthouse calling each other liars. The civil suits went on for several more years, and the families were granted millions of dollars as a result, but money hardly replaces your lost child. As a result of this accident, second assistant director Andy House had his name removed from the credits of Twilight Zone the movie and had it replaced with Alan Smithy. It was the first time that a director of any kind requested the Smithy credit due to a set fatality. Since ADs are a part of the DGA, he was allowed to use the pseudonym officially. I'm sure the others would have loved to have done the same, but the public was all too aware of what happened on that set and who was responsible. This accident saw many, many changes in on-set safety measures. The Federal Aviation Administration had instituted in March of 1983 to regulate how aircraft could be used on a film set. Unfortunately, those rules were only for fixed-wing crafts, meaning more like planes, not helicopters, because there's spin. It was recommended by the National Safety Board after they looked at this case that an amendment be made to the rules to include helicopters, and this went through in 1986. The Screen Actors Guild spokesman at the time, Mark Locker, said at the conclusion of the trial, quote, "The entire ordeal has shaken the industry in its bottom." The guild would start a safety hotline for its members as a direct result of this whole situation to report unsafe shooting conditions. Also in the aftermath, Warner Brothers created dedicated safety committees to establish better standards for explosives and aircrafts and the likes on their film sets. The standards are, to this day, regularly issued as safety bulletins and published as the Injury and Illness Prevention Program, or IIPP, safety manual for television and feature production. The IIPP manual is a, quote, general outline of safe work practices to be used as a guideline for productions to provide a safe work environment and is given to all studio employees. I checked at my job. I don't work for Warner Brothers. We've got our own safety bulletins and situation over there as well. The Directors Guild of America's Safety Committee also began publishing regular safety bulletins for its members and established a hotline for all directors to get 24-hour safety guidance. The Guild also began to discipline its members for violations of its safety procedures on sets, which it had not done prior to the crash. Why have rules if you're not going to also introduce consequences is beyond me, but whatever. As a result of these efforts, filming accidents fell by 69.6% between 1982 and 1986, although there were still six deaths on sets during those intervening years, so about one a year. In 1987, the Office of the State Fire Marshal started the Motion Picture and Entertainment Safety Program in response to the accident and as a way to address industry concerns about the inconsistent enforcement of fire prevention regulations and requirements. The program oversees the motion picture and television industry's use of fire special effects in California. Years later, Landis would speak about the accident in a 1996 interview, saying, quote, "There was absolutely no good aspect about this whole story. The tragedy, which I think about every day, had an enormous impact on my career, from which I may possibly never recover." It should be noted that the year the Twilight Zone movie released, Landis directed Trading Places, which was shot after this whole thing happened. In 1986, he made Three Amigos, starring three of the biggest comedy icons of that era, Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Chevy Chase. In 1988, he made Coming to America with Eddie Murphy and more or less continued working until about 2010. I'm not seeing where this man's career was struggling personally, and a lot of people enjoy his films not knowing of the horrific negligence he allowed to happen on his film set. Landis had also invited the members of the jury on his murder trial to a special screening of his next film, presumably Coming to America based on the timing, as a thank you for the acquittal. In my opinion, and I don't feel like this is a controversial one, so it's why I'm going to throw it in there, he should have never worked again. Over the last month at the time of this recording, we've heard horror stories of recent times, of the last 20 years, about what's been happening to children on film and television sets. This story that I just told you right now is just another example of how long children have been not kept safe on film sets. It's been going on forever. Hell, back in November, I talked about horrible things that happened in the silent era to Jackie Coogan. It's always been a problem. Even right now, you know, forget the child acting thing. The safety stuff. We've got an ongoing high-profile on-set death case that's already seen one individual found guilty of negligence happening right now. It's the Alec Baldwin Rust case with the faulty gun that killed their cinematographer. Like, all of this is just as relevant as it was 40-plus years ago. Progress has been made, but clearly not enough has been done. This accident should have never happened. And while there's still a long way to go as far as set safety is concerned, at least there's a public awareness at large now that keeps people somewhat accountable as much as, you know, is possible. Dangerous stunts have always been a part of the filmmaking process, but that doesn't mean calculated risks can't be taken and safety measures should be ignored in the name of getting that quote unquote perfect shot. Like Spielberg said, "No life should be lost in making a movie. You're making a goddamn movie. You're not doing brain surgery. It's at the end of the day, you know, and people get very intense about it, but you're making movies. It's not that serious. It's fun. It's my favorite thing in the world, but it's not that serious. I know I have a silly, weird job and I love my silly, weird job, but that awareness will keep your blood pressure down if nothing else." The silver lining of this tragedy is that at least individuals in the film business, not in high places of power, can now attempt to ensure the safety of their fellow cast and crew members. In this case, Alan Smithy provided a way for someone who was not directly involved with a tragedy to keep their name clean in the hopes that their career might continue. A second AD would have had absolutely no power in anything that would have happened. And they had no way of you know, calling this in at the time. I'm more or less okay with this credit happening. But at the end of the day, three people were needlessly killed due to extreme negligence, and no one ever spent a day in jail for it or ever truly paid for that negligence. And that's going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media where I also post photos for each episode at Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out with the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I've also got to buy me a coffee. I know someone did it in the last couple of weeks, and I'm horrific at answering my emails. I will thank you next week, but I did see it, and I do appreciate it. I know you've done it before, because I recognize the name, but I totally forgot to write it down, because it, like I said, it'd been weak. But thank you, and I'll thank you by name next week. Hopefully if I remember, next week cannot possibly be as chaotic as this one was. I also got merch. Check it out at the link in the show notes. Next week, we're going to take a look at some of Alan Smithy's work on a couple more films. Unfortunately, the nature of these films, there's not a lot of information on a lot of them, so I'm going to potentially do like a mashup episode. I'm definitely going to try and cover The Birds 2. I definitely want to look at the Hellraiser in Space one. I can't remember what that one's actual name is, but that's what we're going to do next week. It'll be a surprise for both of us. There's a little bit less content than I was hoping there'd be for this, but that's okay because I'm very interested by all this and I'm down to make the effort. So yeah, that's it for this week. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, that's a wrap.